please the court, counsel. My name is Justin Isley. I'm an assistant federal defender for the Federal Public Defender's Office in the Eastern District in the Western District of Arkansas. I'm here to argue on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Racinos. The sole point on appeal here is procedural error from the trial court, wherein the trial court improperly used relevant conduct, a term used under the sentencing guidelines, as a means to assess a statutory mandatory minimum sentence. Mr. Racinos
was a familiar surname you have. Are you related to our great judge?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my grandfather. Mr. Racinos, thank you. Mr. Racinos was originally charged under a 5-count indictment. Each of these counts, as the court is aware, were for possession with intent. There were no conspiracy charges. A plea agreement was entered into. The defendant, Mr. Racinos, pled guilty to one count, which was for possession with intent of 25.3 grams. Subsequently, the other counts were dismissed. A pre-sentence report was created in which the amounts in these possession with intent, even the dismissed counts, were aggregated and calculated for purposes of calculating the sentencing guidelines. In addition, it was deemed by the PSR drafter that this aggregation would qualify to aggregate the sentence under the statutory mandatory minimum, and a 10-year sentence would be proper. Trial counsel agreed that these amounts in the dismissed counts would be relevant conduct under the sentencing guidelines, but did not agree and did object in brief to the fact that relevant conduct would trigger mandatory minimums under the statutory sentences.
So your argument is that for the purposes of imposing the mandatory minimum sentence required by the statute, the trial judge can only consider the quantity of drugs involved in the count of conviction.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe the grill in the corner of the room is this Jenkins case that is an 8th Circuit case mentioned by the appellee, and I would like to first address that case. I think if you look to the
Let me just clarify something. It seems to me this is argued, briefed at least, as a procedural error issue. It seems to me it isn't. It seems to me it's a pure question of statutory interpretation of the statute that compels a mandatory minimum sentence under the prescribed circumstances.
I believe the
procedural error is the Supreme Court creation for advisory guideline sentencing, right?
Right. It was my understanding that this was argued as procedural error because it takes a statutory sentence and argues that and applies a guideline as it is a guideline sentence and applies a guideline principle, which is relevant conduct, and using that to trigger a statutory sentence.
Well, but if the mandatory minimum sentence could not, all right, I see what you mean. Yeah. But
I do see the court's point. I do think that is a term of statutory construction, in that if you look at the
it's favorable to you.
Yes, I'm latching on to that. Yes, Your Honor, and I think if you look at the 2nd and the 4th and the 7th and the 9th Circuit. That's the base of the whole argument. You have a sentencing guideline term.
What you're reminding me is that if we agree with your statutory argument, nonetheless, it just remand for resentencing because the implications to the guideline range has to be reconsidered by the sentencing court. And the guidelines range is driven by the commission's obeisance to mandatory minimum sentences.
That's correct.
So if the minimum sentence is gone, query what impact? Well, I guess the answer could be none, because we don't care what the statute says. We're going to count it as relevant conduct anyway.
And the trial counsel agreed that it was, in fact, relevant conduct as to the dismissed accounts, which created.
So then maybe this is no harm, no foul appeal. Maybe you don't have anything to talk about. In other words, trial counsel gave away the store by making a concession that makes the guideline sentence valid even if the statutory sentence isn't.
But in fact, Your Honor, the guidelines range was 87 to 108 months.
Oh, okay.
And so that is the difference, Your Honor. That's
it's purely a statutory appeal. Guidelines have nothing to do with this.
I agree that the relevant conduct.
And if the minimum sentence gets reversed, then okay, it goes back, and somebody's got to figure out what the guideline sentence is.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the advisory range was what, 87 to?
108 months, Your Honor.
So at most we're assume a guideline sentence at the top of the range of 108 months, and your client received the statutory mandatory minimum of 110, 120 months, so we've got 12 months in the mix.
Unless there's a variance or departure.
Unless there's a variance, or unless there's a sentence at the bottom of the range, and then then it's more than a 12-month argument. Right. I don't mean to deprecate 12 months in prison. I mean that's a deprivation of substantial liberty as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, you don't know of any circuit that's against your position on the statutory construction, right? They're all for you, correct?
As far as I'm aware, I have not seen any circuits say that relevant conduct, a guideline terminology, applies to statutory sentences.
Okay. And I noticed particularly the Sixth. I think the Sixth talks the most, gives the most explication. The Sixth Circuit focuses on the word violation. And they say it's obvious that you look at the violation. It refers to a single violation. I'm paraphrasing, but I'm looking at their words. That's what the Sixth says. They don't focus on the word involving. Do you know what I'm referring to? It says in the case of a violation, and that's where they stop their analysis, and then it says involving. How do you read the word involving? Do you know what I'm referring to in 841? B1? A.
Right. Well, I don't think that is dissimilar to the language used in other circuits when you talk about the offense conduct. What is it under this statute, this offense, which was clearly delineated in the indictment, that caused this person to be guilty of the offense, which is this delivery of this specific amount of drugs on this certain day? You know, what muddies the water, or what could appear to muddy the water, is when you start talking about conspiracy cases, when relevant conduct and offense conduct might not look so different. And I think that, you know, the difference, because when one of the cases, I can't remember if it was the Smith case, talks about there not being so much difference between relevant conduct and offense conduct.
Well, in Jenkins, in order for you to avoid what's implied in the discussion of Jenkins, don't you have to say that the drugs and the cash that were found in his room after the controlled buy were drugs of drugs and cash on his person, all of that was involved in the same offense because he'd just taken part of his stash at home and brought it out on the street.
Right.
So therefore you can distinguish Jenkins.
Right. Well, and I think
in other words, involved has to be more than the three rocks in his pocket when he tried to sell one to an undercover agent.
Right, and the arguments originally on that appeal were sufficiency of the evidence in this improper conversion of cash to drugs. It was sent up and came back on a Kimbrough, and I'm generally a trial attorney, but you could see where the drugs were close in time that you wouldn't make an argument such as we're making here today. It might not look so different, whereas I think it's pretty clear that these other offenses, although they're relevant conduct under the sentencing guidelines, would not rise to offense conduct under the statutory
language. Well, let me look at it a different way. What evidence was there that could be considered at sentencing? I say that carefully. I mean, including unobjected evidence in the PSR, and anything said or at the plea hearing. What evidence was there as to whether all five sales were involved in a single offense?
Of course, as Representative Mr. Sinos, I did not see any particular connection. Although they were in the same indictment, when the trial judge, made his decision, he point blank said it's relevant conduct. Yet I'm still doing the mandatory minimum. And he said, I believe there is a circuit split. Which my argument would be, there's not a circuit split. I think it's the rule of this court. It's that offense conduct, whether conspiracy or possession with intent to deliver, is what triggers the mandatory minimum sentence. And I see that I'm out of time. I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Quinn?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Matthew Quinn, represent the United States. Would like to start off by addressing the argument that Mr. Rezinos makes in regard to the Jenkins case, somehow supporting his position that that the relevant conduct shouldn't apply in his case. In the Jenkins case, as the court is aware, Mr. Jenkins had in his possession, I think in his pocket, 0.14 grams of crack cocaine, or 0.84 grams of crack cocaine. In his apartment, he had approximately 14 grams of crack cocaine. And then the bulk of the crack cocaine that was attributed to him came from this cash equivalent conversion. That was 80-odd grams of crack cocaine. And that's a relevant conduct conversion. The cash equivalent conversion, that's not a statutory argument or statutory position.
So we inadvertently created a circuit conflict in Jenkins in an issue that we didn't discuss?
I don't think you inadvertently created a conflict.
We intentionally created it?
No, sir. I think
wouldn't we have said we're doing this and we know what we're doing?
Well, I think the Smith case laid the groundwork for this, Your Honor, in that.
No. Smithy was convicted of conspiracy.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, let's not go off the road,
Well, I think
the campus here.
Well, respectfully,
we're talking about cases where there was no conspiracy conviction,
right?
Charge conviction,
right?
And Jenkins is one of those.
I think the distinction between conspiracy and non-conspiracy cases, when it comes to relevant conduct, quantity of drugs, is that in conspiracy cases, as the court in Smith stated, and Agallo Delgado, and other cases, is that a defendant can be attributed relevant conduct drugs that other co-conspirators are responsible for. And that's what the judge in the Smith case said.
You're obviously too young to have gone to law school when Pinkerton was about half the criminal law course.
I am young, yes, sir.
The substantial difference in the criminal law created to a large extent by Pinkerton persists. And this is an offshoot or an example of it.
Except when you get into the sentencing guidelines where the sentencing liability of a defendant in a conspiracy case is substantially different from criminal liability under the Pinkerton case. I want to ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume that this defendant was a one-stop shop for drugs of all kinds, and you've got five counts involving five different drugs, and he pleads guilty to one count. Now, are you permitted under relevant conduct to, for the purposes of the mandatory minimum, to aggregate the different drugs from the different counts to sentence him to a mandatory minimum under the one count of the offense of conviction?
Well, I think under my theory, yes, Your Honor.
Under our cases, you can't.
Yeah, can't aggregate different drugs.
We've got a case called, and I have difficulty pronouncing it, Alaniz, A-L-A-N-I-Z, where we specifically held that you cannot use different drugs, you cannot aggravate different drugs to trigger a mandatory minimum. Now, what's the difference with this case?
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that in Jenkins, the court aggregated the cash equivalent quantity of crack cocaine.
Same drug.
Yes, Your Honor, but it was cash, and I would also, just to go further, state that there's nothing in the record to show that large amount of cash that was in his apartment, 80 some odd grams worth of cash, was related to the 0.8 grams in his pocket or the 14 grams that he had in his apartment. That's a huge difference of 80 grams worth of cash compared to the 14 grams of crack and the less than 1 gram in his pocket. And I would argue, as far as the offense conduct goes, Your Honor, in this case, with Mr. Resinos, he's charged with five counts of delivery, and those all occurred within less than a 30-day time period. You have five controlled buys between June and July of last year, less than 30 days. And I would argue that that's the same course of conduct. It's the same common scheme, common plan, which is what's defined as relevant conduct under the guidelines.
Did anyone deliberately exceed, what are we talking here, 50 grams?
No, Your Honor. Not any one delivery did not exceed 50 grams of actual. I think the most was this instant charge that he was convicted under.
So, counsel, you're ready to defend this in the United States Supreme Court and face all the other circuits, right? That's what you're telling us.
Well, Judge, I think, yes, sir, I think the Eighth Circuit position on this matter is, you know, different than what the other circuits that have addressed this issue are.
But we've never discussed it.
Or can we expect the Solicitor General to back away?
Well, he won't have to defend it. He'll sell you out.
I can't speak to that, but... Judge Loken, with regard to the Jenkins case, you indicated that that wasn't discussed. But you're right, it wasn't specifically discussed.
But I think it was my position,
Your Honor, it was made an issue, and that this court needed to justify the sentencing court's 120-month sentence in that case. And the way that this court did that was stating that the mandatory minimum was 10 years because of the relevant conduct that was involved in that case. And I think that although it wasn't directly discussed, that was the result of the decision, and that's why that decision was reached.
Well, if Sandlin had been argued to the panel in Jenkins, I don't know what they would have done with it. Yeah. It wasn't argued.
Right.
I mean, the guidelines relevant conduct principles was just accepted as the way you do things in that opinion. It reads pretty clearly to me. Now, I think this question of what involves means is we're opening up something very interesting.
Yes, sir.
Do you, since nobody thought of it in the district court, do you concede that it wasn't, there isn't the evidentiary basis to conclude that this was one offense? All the drugs were part of one offense, properly construing the word involves in the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I think when you look at the word involves, I go back to the guideline definition of relevant conduct, which is part of that is a common scheme.
But don't forget relevant conduct. Relevant conduct, that's Pinkerton conspiracy talk.
I still think involves is the overall act of the charged offenses. And like I indicated, you have deliveries that occurred in less than a 30-day time period, same MO, same confidential informant, same drugs, same locations. It's the same offense as it relates to the involved.
The trouble is you're just sort of pulling a card out of the ditch. It would have been very easy to charge this and negotiate a plea agreement that made this clear. In my experience, it's relatively rare that a conspiracy count isn't included, as in Smith. And you don't have the problem. Then you're clearly in guideline, with Pinkerton, even the guidelines, you've got it nailed. But here... nobody thought about whether the five sales could be aggregated if only one was charged.
I guess, the mandatory minimums are in place for a reason, and that's, Congress decided that people who sell a certain quantity of drugs should be held accountable to a higher standard.
Well, the Sixth Circuit says, go ahead.
In a violation of the statute.
Yes, sir. Well, why? I guess my question.
A violation of the statute.
Yes, sir. Rhetorically, I mean, why should drug dealers who are who sell drugs and aren't involved in the conspiracy be held to a lesser standard than someone who happens just by happenstance to be involved in a conspiracy?
Well, one doesn't get involved in the conspiracy by happenstance. One has to join a conspiracy. There has to be affirmative conduct on the part of the defendant before he can be found guilty of conspiracy.
But I don't. My position, Your Honors, I don't believe that just because you conspire with another person, that's a more severe offense, and you should be held accountable for a greater amount of drugs than an individual deliverer who has dealt the same amount of drugs as he would have if a co-conspirator would have been involved in it.
Sandlin just gives you more plea bargaining discretion, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's all I have for the court.
Accepting the sort of equitable legitimacy of what you're arguing, the rule that if you only charge individual transactions, there's a more favorable sentencing computation lot of prosecutors like that. It gives them discretion to negotiate.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, I think, you know, there was in the defendant's brief, well, I'll see, I'm out of time. In the defendant's brief on that issue that, it, you know, will affect plea negotiations with, you know, between the prosecutor and defendant. I mean, a lot of times the guidelines affect that anyway. And so no matter, you know, I can, if you dismiss some counts and have them plead guilty to a count, it doesn't matter. It's still going to be at the mandatory minimum. They're still, you know, their guideline sentence is going to be above the mandatory minimum. And the guidelines sort of tie our hands anyway when it comes to negotiation of drug, you know, most drug crimes anyway. That's all I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Isley, have some time?
Just about a minute.
Mr. Isley, please tell me why Jenkins doesn't close you out here.
Your Honor, Jenkins, the case was decided on the issue of first sufficiency, also erroneous conversion of cash to drugs for purposes of the guidelines. It was subsequently decided on Kimbrough, and at no point did this court address the specific issue of relevant conduct versus offense conduct. And I think, obviously I haven't talked to trial counsel, but I could see where that would actually be purposeful. And so I do not think at this point there is a circuit split. However, I do think if the appellee's argument was accepted, it would create one.
Well, this is important. The next to last paragraph of Jenkins, I think, contradicts what you just said. You don't have a copy of Jenkins, do you? Handy. If you don't worry about it. Are you familiar with the next to last paragraph of the Jenkins case?
I believe it's quoted in maybe the appellee's brief.
I think it is too, yeah.
Right.
So you are familiar with it. How do you say that doesn't address it? I know it's not explicit, but I guess it depends on what you mean by explicit.
Right.
Help me on the next to last paragraph of Jenkins.
The appellant, who has the burden of addressing the issue, did not address the issue whether purposefully or not purposefully, felt like he had a better argument. And arguably, with the way the facts were set up, he did not feel it was a good argument based on offense conduct versus relevant conduct. And I think, if I may finish as a last point, the trial attorney in this case is very good, and I would venture to say that if he did not think he was getting the benefit of the bargain of avoiding a statutory mandatory minimum sentence, he would probably try this case once a day and maybe twice on Sundays. So thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case has been well briefed and argued. It's an interesting issue, kind of a sneaky one, at least for us. But it's important. We will take it under advisement.